Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Ann Ball, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
On Tuesday, the United States Department of Defense announced it was halting operational training of all Saudi Arabian military personnel in the U.S. until further notice. The announcement came less than a week after a Saudi Air Force lieutenant shot and killed three people at a U.S. naval airbase in Pensacola, Florida. The department's decision will have far-reaching effects on visiting Saudi military personnel, including grounding more than 300 Saudi Arabian flight students. The move also affects all other Saudi military training programs, except classroom training. Such coursework, which includes English language classes, will continue. Many U.S. military bases provide an economic engine for the communities in which they operate. But the Navy has a special relationship with the city of Pensacola that is built on hundreds of years of history. A large number of the 52,000 people who live in the Pensacola area are people who first came to the city because of the naval base. Gary Yetter spent 21 years in the Navy and used to call the northwestern state of Washington his home. The Navy brought him to Pensacola twice, and after retiring, he made it his home for good. He worked part-time at the base in a non-military position and eventually opened a beer-making business. Everybody says, "Are you from Pensacola?" And most people say, "No, I'm from somewhere else." "But we all move here eventually," said Yetter. Escambia County Sheriff David Morgan first came to Pensacola as a member of the Air Force and returned to the city when he retired. Morgan recently met with reporters shortly after the shooting last Friday. During that press conference, he noted that the Pensacola community is hurt because it opens its heart and homes to foreign nationals who train at the base. "We opened our country to the Allied officers. We opened our hearts. Many of the folks that surround our military base do sponsorships, where they sponsor officers into their homes to do a cultural exchange," Morgan said. "You should have walked the crime scene with us, and you'd understand the anger in this community right now." The military history of the area dates back to 1698, when Spain built a fort in the same area where the American base is now. French forces destroyed the Spanish fort in 1719. The Spanish later built Fort San Carlos de Barrancas in 1797, and some of that structure is still on the current base. U.S. President John Quincy Adams ordered the establishment of a Navy yard on the land, and building began in 1826. Flight training at the base began in the years before the U.S. entered World War I. Pensacola takes a lot of pride in its military base. One local school is even named for the highly skilled, Blue Angels flying team based there. A Blue Angels jet is permanently positioned over the city's visitor welcome center, made to look like it is flying above the building. After the attack, the community went into action. The day of the shooting, people lined up to give blood at a local blood donation center. The next day, people continued to come in to donate blood as their way to try to help. "It's about the least I can do," said Navy Ensign Kyle Herring, who has been stationed at the base for about a year. "There's not really much else I can do in my position except give blood and try to provide comfort." Pensacola is really welcoming to all the Navy folks, and it's really hard when we have our brothers and sisters get shot and killed. I'm Pete Musto.
They. This common pronoun is what Merriam-Webster chose for the word of 2019. For hundreds of years, they generally has meant more than one person. But increasingly, they is being used instead of he or she to describe a non-binary person, one who does not identify as male or female. The dictionary company says it chose they because of a 313% increase this year in people looking it up on their site. "I have to say it's surprising to me," said Peter Sokolowski, a lexicographer and Merriam-Webster's editor at large. "It's a word we all know and love. So many people were talking about this word." Sokolowski and his team watch for spikes or sharp increases in word searches. Searches for they increased last January with the rise of model Oslo Grace. Grace, who uses the pronoun they, walks in both men's and women's fashion shows around the world. Nick Adams is with the LGBTQ group GLAAD. He said Merriam-Webster's choice is a positive step in recognizing non-binary people. Editor Peter Sokolowski told the Associated Press that they, one of a few non-binary pronouns to emerge in recent years, is here to stay. 4 years ago, members of the American Dialect Society also voted for they as the word of the year. Another language organization, Dictionary.com, chose existential as the 2019 winner. The adjective means connected to existence. The choice shows how threats and crises, real and thought about, affected the world in 2019. John Kelly is senior research editor for the site. He says, in our data, it speaks to this sense of grappling with our survival. I'm Ann Ball. Thank you.
China says millions of legal cases are now being decided by internet courts that do not require citizens to appear in court. The smart court includes non-human judges powered by artificial intelligence, or AI. People seeking legal action can register their case on the internet. They can then take part in a digital court hearing. The system gives users the chance to communicate and receive court decisions by text or through major messaging services. China's first internet court was established in the eastern city of Hangzhou in 2017. Hangzhou is a center for major Chinese technology companies. Last week, the country's Supreme People's Court released a report on the court's activities. Users completed more than 3.1 million legal activities through the court system from March to October of this year, China's official Xinhua news agency reported. More than 1 million citizens were registered with the system, along with about 73,000 lawyers, the report said. Judicial officials recently invited reporters to the Hangzhou Internet Court to see how it operates. In one demonstration, citizens used video messaging to communicate with virtual AI-powered judges, the French press agency AFP reported. Does the defendant have any objection to the nature of the judicial blockchain evidence submitted by the plaintiff? A virtual judge asked during a pretrial meeting. The non-human judge was represented in the system by an image of a man wearing a black robe. No objection, the human plaintiff answered. A Hangzhou court official told China's state-run CGTN television the internet court system operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It is designed to ease the workload of humans and improve the speed and effectiveness of the legal process. Court officials say that even though virtual judges are used, human judges observe the process and can make major rulings. The Internet Court in Hangzhou only deals with cases involving legal disputes over digital matters. These include internet trade issues, copyright cases, and disputes over online product sales. Digital court cases in China have seen a sharp increase in recent years as the number of mobile payments and internet-based businesses has grown. The growth is tied to China's huge number of internet users, about 850 million. Blockchain is one of the digital technologies used in the court system. Blockchain is the name for an official list of transactions carried out between users belonging to the same group of computers. The technology permits transaction records to be checked and stored safely. Ni Dafeng is vice president of the Hangzhou Internet Court. He told reporters the use of blockchain was particularly useful in helping to reduce paperwork and create clearer records of the legal process. Ni noted that he thinks the system's ability to provide quick results helps give citizens more quality justice. Because justice delayed is justice denied, he said. After establishing the court in Hangzhou, China launched similar operations in the cities of Beijing and Guangzhou. Courts nationwide are also experimenting with several digital tools, said Zhou Qiang, Chief Justice and President of the Supreme People's Court. He told reporters last week that as of October, more than 90% of Chinese courts were using some form of online tools to help deal with cases. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On July 4th, 1863, a huge Confederate army surrendered at Vicksburg, Mississippi. Union forces had surrounded the city for 47 days. Food was gone. The situation was hopeless. The Confederate commander gave up. The terms of surrender were simple. The Confederate soldiers promised not to fight anymore. In return for this promise, they were released on parole and sent home to their families. Never had Union forces won such a victory. 30,000 Confederate soldiers were now out of the war. 60,000 guns and 170 cannon were now in Union hands. The Mississippi River was now under Union control. Larry West and Morris Joyce continue our story of the American Civil War.
The victory at Vicksburg went to General Ulysses Grant. He was named commander of all Union armies in the West. Then he was sent to Chattanooga, Tennessee. The Union army there had just been defeated in a battle along a little river called the Chickamauga. Now the Union soldiers were resting and reorganizing in Chattanooga. The Confederate line stretched halfway around the city. The Confederates had artillery on Lookout Mountain. They controlled every road into the city, except a rough one through the mountains. They had blocked the Tennessee River above and below the city. And they had cut the railroad. The Confederate general said he would let hunger force the Union army to surrender.
Grant arrived in Chattanooga late in October. The city was full of hungry Union soldiers. They had been without supplies for almost a month. Grant wasted no time. He quickly sent troops to fight the Confederate force blocking the Tennessee River. He sent others to fight the Confederates blocking the road to the nearest Union supply center. Within 1 week, supply wagons were rolling into Chattanooga. Within a few weeks, the defeated Union army was ready to fight again.
General Grant sent his men against the middle and ends of the Confederate line at the same time. There were few Confederate soldiers at Lookout Mountain. That end of the line fell easily. The center of the line was along a low hill called Missionary Ridge. It held for a while. Then Union soldiers, acting without orders, forced their way to the top of the hill. The Confederate line broke. Southern soldiers threw down their guns and ran for their lives. The Confederate army withdrew south into the state of Georgia. Tennessee was completely in Union hands. the way was now open for the armies of the North to march into the heart of the Confederacy.
It was clear that the South could not win the war. Too many Confederate soldiers had fallen in battle. None were left to take their place. Supplies were very low. There was not enough food to eat, no shoes to wear, and little left to fight with. No one held any hope of getting supplies from outside the Confederacy. The South was circled by Union troops and warships. All seemed lost. Yet Confederate soldiers refused to stop fighting. They would not surrender. The war would not end until the Confederate armies were defeated by military force.
There was no question that the North had the military strength. Supplies were no problem. Factories were producing more than ever before. Manpower was no problem. Men continued to join the Union Army. Fewer than before, but still enough to make it a powerful force. The problem with the Union Army was its generals. Some were too careful. Some were unwilling to fight. Some did not know how to fight. The only general who seemed able to win victories was Ulysses Grant. That is why President Abraham Lincoln named Grant commander of all Union armies. Lincoln depended on him to end the Civil War.
Grant went east in March 1864, 5 months after the battle at Chattanooga. He decided to make his headquarters in the field with the Army of the Potomac. He said he would not command from an office in Washington, but he went to the city to explain his plans to President Lincoln. Grant noted that, in the past, the separate Union armies had moved and fought independently. He said they were like a poorly trained team of horses. No two of them ever pulled at the same time in the same direction. Under his command, Grant said, the Union armies would pull together. They would hit the Confederates with so much strength in so many places that the rebels could not stop them. Grant said all the armies would attack at the same time.
Grant spent the month of April preparing for the big campaign. The main target, once again, was the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. The Army of the Potomac had 120,000 men. It would move against Richmond from the north. General Ben Butler had 50,000 men. He would move against Richmond from the east. General Franz Sigel would bring thousands more through the Shenandoah Valley to the northwest. These forces were three times the size of Robert E. Lee's army near Richmond. In the west, William Sherman had three armies with more than 100,000 men. His opponent, Joe Johnston, had just 60,000.
General Grant kept details of the campaign as secret as possible. Reporters asked President Lincoln when Grant would move. The president answered, "Ask General Grant." "General Grant will not tell us," said the reporters. Said Lincoln, "He will not tell me either." The final Union campaign of the Civil War began on May 3, 1864. After 2 days of marching, the Army of the Potomac reached the wilderness. It was a thickly wooded area west of Fredericksburg, Virginia. That was where the Union Army had lost a battle to the Confederates 1 year before. That was where the two armies would fight again.
The battle quickly became a blind struggle. The woods were thick. The smoke was heavy. The soldiers could not see each other until they were very close. Shells set the trees on fire. The wounded could not escape the flames. Their screams filled the air. After 2 days, General Grant decided that the Wilderness was not the place to fight Robert E. Lee. He wanted to get around the end of Lee's army. He wanted to fight in the open, where he could use his artillery. So he began to march his men toward a place called Spotsylvania Courthouse.
Lee moved his men as fast as Grant. When the Union Army got to Spotsylvania, the Confederates were waiting behind walls of earth and stone. For several more days, the two armies fought. At times, they were so close they had no time to load and fire their guns. So they used their guns to hit each other. The Confederate line bent, but it never broke. Once again, Lee had stopped the Union Army. Grant refused to accept defeat. He said he would fight to the finish, if it took all summer. Once again, he ordered his men to march around the end of Lee's line. Lee quickly pulled his men back to a place called Cold Harbor, not far from Richmond. There they waited.
As he had done in the Wilderness and at Spotsylvania, Grant ordered his men to attack hard. It was a slaughter. In less than an hour, 7,000 Union soldiers fell dead or wounded. Grant finally stopped the attack. The Union soldiers returned to their lines. They left behind hundreds of wounded men. For 4 days, the wounded lay on the battlefield crying for help, for water. Men who tried to rescue them were shot down. Finally, Grant and Lee agreed on a ceasefire to take care of the wounded and bury the dead. It was too late for most of the wounded. They had died.
The battle at Cold Harbor ended 1 month of fighting for the Army of the Potomac. The campaign had brought it almost to the edge of Richmond, the Confederate capital. But Grant had paid a terrible price. More than 50,000 dead and wounded. Confederate losses were much lighter, about 20,000. General Grant was beginning to learn an important lesson of the war. The methods of defense had improved much more than the methods of attack.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.